When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. On this season of Working, we left the East Coast behind and flew to Detroit. We're speaking with eight people who are drawing on the city's complex history as they work to create its future. For this week's episode, we sat down with Jen Guarino, Vice President of Manufacturing for Shinola, a company that makes watches, leather goods, and much more right in Detroit itself. She talks about the larger challenges of manufacturing in the United States today, but she also breaks down some of the more quotidian details of her day-to-day responsibilities. Guarino, whose desk is located right on the factory floor, also discusses the effort that she puts into hiring and training the company's workforce. She talks about Shinola's relationship to the city of Detroit and explores a lot more besides. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Guarino gives us an audio tour of the factory itself. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
Jen Guarino, and I am Vice President of Manufacturing here at Shinola.
What falls under the umbrella of manufacturing here at Shinola where we are today in Detroit?
So my role is a potpourri of things, which means that anything that is needed to support manufacturing, I might have my hands in. Mm-hmm. So in the case of watches, something we've been doing for a while, doesn't really need much of my support. In the case of something that is new for us, like audio.
Mm-hmm. You're making turntables.
Turntables, headphones, I might be more involved in that. Mm-hmm. And primarily because manufacturing in the United States is incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. And so, whether we have people here that have made a product before, we usually bring in experts in a field to help us develop and engineer product here. Whether they've done that before or not, most of them have not done it in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there to help sort of navigate through all the challenges that exist no matter what you're trying to make in the United States.
So you're facilitating the very possibility of production?
Correct.
Here?
Correct. And that's anything from, when you're manufacturing in the United States, there's this long list of challenges. And what we try to do is learn from, you know, the first time around and apply those or leverage those lessons across other product categories as we take on the manufacturing of new product. Sometimes it translates, sometimes it doesn't. Oftentimes you're talking about having to train a whole workforce that has never made the product we're making. Mm-hmm. In the case of leather goods, for example, there was not a huge population of people that had experience in manufacturing leather goods, so we had to retrain an entire workforce that had been in some other form of manufacturing. In the case of leather goods, I would even argue that was our largest investment. So you'll find that over and over again, because when manufacturing left the US, of course the training stopped. Mm. So that's a big part of what we do, is trying to find effective, cost-effective ways to train future masters. Mm-hmm.
So you have all of these different areas. Shinola makes watches, leather goods of various kinds, bags, watch straps, belts, I think we saw when we were walking through the factory floor earlier. What do you spend the most of your time focused on these days?
My day largely consists of finding ways to elevate people to their next career path, because for us to grow, we need the people that we've trained to continue to increase their competencies in an area.
When you say the people, you mean the folks actually making the products?
Folks making the products are key to our business. So we don't want them to come in and have a job where they start manufacturing something in one capacity and stay there for 20 years. You know, what we want to do is find a path for them that's in line with what we expect our growth to be. So in the case of leather goods, for example, we've had several people that have been promoted into line leadership positions, supervisor positions, product engineering positions. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of energy on finding the most effective ways to do that while maintaining our output and quality. It's a mm-hmm. delicate dance to do all those things at once. You're an educator, you're a manufacturer. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say that I'm very involved with is developing partnership with other manufacturers in the United States, because we have suppliers of all kinds and we also use contract manufacturers.
And one of the things is, I understand it, that to get a made in the US label, virtually every component of a product has to be from the United States usually, right?
In order to stamp made in the USA, the FTC has very, very rigorous guidelines. You know, for us, we don't focus so much on made in USA stamp, in quotation, but show people how we manufacture things. And then we're very transparent about where we get everything, all the components. One of the big, big issues in manufacturing in the United States, particularly if you're striving to be, made in the USA by the FTC standards, is that our supply chain is broken. So there might be something that you, with all good intent, want to manufacture in the United States, but the components just simply are not available, or you might have to make them available by, creating a whole nother business to manufacture something, and it takes you right out of the price competition, right? So
Can you give an example of some component or something that would be?
Sure. Let's see. Let's just say watch movements. If we were to make all the components in a watch movement that we get, from Switzerland and overseas, the tooling behind that would be so cost prohibitive that we would not be able to offer our watches at the cost we're able to offer them now. It wouldn't make mathematical sense. So we're constantly balancing those things. Now, the supply chain is also challenged in that many of our suppliers have been hurt over the last several decades. So, they deserve great kudos for still being in business. However, they don't have deep pockets and huge resources to necessarily always grow at the rate we need them to grow with us, or to be able to develop the things that we need to develop with them. So oftentimes we find ourselves in a position of going beyond just placing a purchase order for a component, but literally partnering with them to get the necessary equipment that's needed to help them come up with the resources to meet our demands. And it didn't used to be like that.
You mean, when you say it didn't used to be like that, you mean so decades ago?
So decades ago, for instance, in specifically leather goods, 25, 30 years ago, the supply chain, the industry was healthy. So, these companies were cash flowing. So they could afford to have inventory. They could afford to develop product. They could afford to train people. But when that business started going away, it just took everything they had just to keep their doors open. So years later, when we began to see a reshoring of the demand, their reservoirs were dry. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes we have to find creative ways to make sure their reservoirs are healthy enough that we can grow together.
Do you spend much time on the road with suppliers, or are you just on the phone with people a lot?
I go out to visit a lot of potential manufacturers, suppliers. So it's really nice to get a chance to, see an operator in operation, mm-hmm. and to really understand what kind of what state they're in, and face to face is always best, right? So I do that quite a bit. Once we sort of have a vendor that is performing for us, our purchasing team takes good care of them, and I don't have to be involved as much. So I would say I'm more involved in leveraging new relationships across categories.
What does that mean, new relationships? So just finding those new vendors?
Yeah, finding new vendors and finding multiple ways they might be a good partner for us, because we have so many different kind of products we manufacture. We might find a manufacturer to answer a certain demand we have for a certain component or manufacturing, and then realize that, wow, as we get in there, they could also make A, B, C, and D for the audio team or for the jewelry team or for this team. So that's probably a big part of what I do, is really understanding the full competency and the full offerings of some of the partners.
So as the demand for onshoring of production has increased over the years, have the supply chain issues that you talked about changed at all? Are things getting better, or do the frustrations they experienced at the beginning remain as you've moved ahead?
Depending on the day that you ask me how healthy the supply chain is, I might say, you know, it's just as frustrating as ever. But if I really step back and look at what it's like now versus, let's just say, 5 years ago, there are definite improvements. We've seen factories hire people back. We've seen factories that we work with have to get more square footage and hire more people. A factory that, you know, had six people that now has 30. That's on time every month. It's doing high quality stuff for us. We've seen our supply chain begin to grow, and it's not without its challenges. And I think now we're smarter about when we begin a relationship with the supplier, because we know that it's likely it's going to have a certain set of challenges that you wouldn't have maybe in another country. But I think we have a better mindset on how to approach those things. But overall, I think we've seen an improvement in the supply chain overall. And I think one thing that I find very encouraging is that out of pure need, that industry is now sharing supply chain with each other much more than they would have, let's say, 20 years ago, when you didn't share your supply chain, your resource list. You just didn't do that. You know, you kind of protected those things. I think that out of pure need, people aren't doing that anymore. So they do share their vendor base, their supply base in a really positive way. So I see the trend as a positive one and becoming more healthy. But it's, you know, it's still, there's still very, very real challenges. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had to end a relationship with a vendor? Is that something that you're involved in?
I think that we've seen vendors, you know, in their relationship with us and us with them, because sometimes you just discover that the expectation or what the need is, isn't a match. Mm-hmm. For example, if you go to a tannery and you ask them to, you know, to tan a leather that they've never done before, and they say, sure, we can do that because they want the business, and then you find out after 9 months of trying that that was a really bad idea for them and you, then it's really good for you just to shake hands and say, hey, man, you know, good luck to you, but, you know, this is not a match. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to be really candid with each other. And we really try to, we say, you know, we like to deal with vendors with a hug first and a bat, you know, never. So what we really like to say is, you know, let's work with each other to get this right. And if it's apparent that it's not going to get where we need to get for you and for us, then yeah, it's best to part ways. But we try to get that understanding much sooner in the game than maybe we used to.
So with all of that, all of these different responsibilities, people that you're in touch with here and elsewhere, is there such a thing as a typical day for you on a typical day in the office here in Detroit?
Well, I would say that my typical day starts the same in Detroit, in that I always do my laps. So my desk is in the factory for a reason. I like to be close to the action. I like to hear everything humming. I'm one of those people that, you know, if I sit next to you or near you, I'll want to know all about you. So I like to walk around the factory, say hello to folks, you know, see how things are going. And so that is the way I start every day when I'm in Detroit. That is just something that I do and I enjoy doing. And it's amazing what you find out about your business when you do that. So that's consistent.
how long are you here? When do you get to head out at the end of the day?
Well, it depends. My days change depending on when it starts. For example, on Wednesday mornings, I come in and start the day at 7 like everybody else does, just to talk to everybody. So we have morning meetings with the factory. So I come in just to, you know, either cheerlead or tell them that, you know, what kind of news we might have on the company that they may not hear otherwise.
Is that an all-staff factory meeting?
That's in the leather factory.
Okay.
And so,
but that's the whole production floor that's involved in a meeting like that?
The whole factory, yep. And that includes line leaders, supervisors, engineers, so on. And on those days, you know, I will leave earlier, like probably 5. When I come in at 9, you know, I usually don't get out of here before 6. And then at night, I kind of like to take that time just to catch up on emails that, you know, I just don't get to in a day.
That's with vendors or people outside the organization?
Vendors mostly? Or just getting caught up in, you know, a list of emails that I might be CC'd on, but I don't necessarily need to respond to, but I just, it's sort of an information gathering time for me to be able to do that without distraction.
What about the middle of the day? What are you doing between those early meetings and checking your email at the end of the day?
The bulk of my day, let's just say, you know, between 11 and 4, is a ton of meetings with different categories to find ways for us to become better at what we're doing. And that could range from, look, we've got some leather challenges. We've got some tanneries that aren't really meeting our demands. Let's get together and talk about where we're at. Let's look at the leathers as they stand today. Let's set up some benchmarks to get the leather we need by when. And then the next minute, I might be meeting with the audio team to talk about, you know, how our driver is coming for our new headphone, and is it on time, and is there anything we need to do to support the supply chain so that we meet our launch in October. So it's, I don't know how else to describe it except that I am sort of a customer service provider for all the production demands we have, manufacturing demands. And so my day is many times driven by the demands of our internal customers, right? So, and then beyond that, Every day, I spend some time, and it varies, on workforce development. And that really is, you know, how are we training? What are we doing to further the people's careers here in manufacturing? Because we really believe that it's important that people understand that manufacturing is not what it used to be. So I kind of, in the back of my mind, am always thinking, how can we help demonstrate that there shouldn't be a negative stigma attached to manufacturing?
What do you mean by to manufacturing jobs, you mean?
To manufacturing jobs, right. So in any product manufacturing, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about making, you know, car components or leather goods. When you talk to folks that are in those fields, they will tell you that one of the biggest challenges they have is finding skilled people. And the reason for that is people aren't going into manufacturing anymore because it's got a negative stigma attached. You know, you should go and get a 4-year degree and pursue something far away from manufacturing. Well, we're really committed to showing that manufacturing is honorable and it is a good career, and it doesn't have to be, look or sound like it used to. So when I say manufacturing to you, you probably get a certain vision in your head of what a factory might look like. It's probably something like behind cinder block walls, probably no windows, probably a little dirty, probably fluorescent lights, probably, you know, right? So the list goes on. Well, in our factory, when you walk in, you'll notice an immediate difference. It does not look or sound like that at all. So we do have playlists. We have music going, and those playlists are generated by a group effort. You know, we thumbs up or thumbs down the music so that, you know, we can all enjoy some music in the day. The lighting in the factory, the equipment in the factory, the window seats that our artisans have that you normally wouldn't see in a factory, those are all things that contribute to a very, very, very different vision of manufacturing.
Those are things that would presumably contribute to someone's mental health when they're involved in manufacturing.
Absolutely.
But do those change kind of larger perceptions of manufacturing? It seems like that's important to you as well, right?
I think one of the most, I would say, rewarding pieces of being here at Shinola is being a leader in changing the perception of manufacturing. And I think we're effectively doing that. When people walk into our factory and they see it and they talk to the folks that, you know, actually have smiles on their faces and want to show them the work that they do, that goes a long way. That goes a really long way. And that's the stuff people like paying for. They like understanding what they're paying for. So I think that Shinola plays a very key role in hopefully leading a parade of, I would say, let's just call it innovators in the approach to manufacturing. And just 2 weeks ago, we had a gal from Detroit Public Schools. She was here for 9 weeks. She was in the factory with us. And as I got to know her, I found out, wow, this gal, she's trying to make things at home. She's really interested in making three-dimensional things with her hands. She was developing all these things at home. So for her to be able to come into a factory and actually see something go from design to production engineering to something that we now can go out and sell in the marketplace was thrilling for her. She didn't even know a job existed like that. Mm. So those are huge, big, little wins, shall we call them, right? Sure. And she'll be back.
I noticed also that you use words to describe the workers in the factory, like artisan, that are not terms we would normally see applied, at least in the kind of stereotype that you were describing earlier of what a factory looks like in the sort of theater of the mind. Artisan is not the word that typically comes up. Is there attentiveness to the kind of language that you use to talk about the workforce here as well? Does that play into what you're trying to do?
It's really important for us that the people making the product are referred to in a way that feels honorable, right? So they're not laborers or not hourly factory workers, they're artisans. And what we mean by that is artisan implies a certain level of expertise. Mm-hmm. And in the leather factory, for example, it's not a plug and play, you know, put a square thing in a square hole. It really is part science and part craft, because every leather piece that passes you, you have to use judgment and an aesthetic to say, is this unique leather piece okay to pass onto the next station because it's met our standards? And if it's not, what am I going to do about that? Can I manipulate it? Can I treat it? Is there something that I can do to make sure that this piece passes? So that takes some discretion. It takes some confidence to make a decision on your own as you're working on product. And that is a very, very different approach to manufacturing, where you are actually part of making decisions all the way down the line. So those things are important to us. And what we call them, where we eat. You know, if you come into our headquarters, there's a reason why we all share the same lunchroom, where we share the same, you know, break areas, we share the same entries. That is highly unusual for a headquarters. Usually manufacturing is in the back 40, and that workforce is very separated. That's not the case here. And that just changes the overall feeling that we're all here for the same reason.
I wonder, though, how does it change your sense of your role as a manager? You talk about having your desk on the factory floor, about sitting with people as they're doing their work and, you know, getting that kind of close view of the process. Does it ever make it more difficult to be the boss, though, when you're that proximate to the action, to the workforce?
I think that the decision to sit in the factory is in one way more challenging, because it's loud and it's crazy and you're available for anybody to come up to your desk at any time. You might be right in the middle of something. But the benefits far outweigh any of those, whether you want to call them annoyances or challenges, because you really find out things much sooner. People are much more candid with what's going on. And I think it avails them to the heartbeat of the company in many senses. So they're not just listening to, you know, the beat of, you know, whatever machine is running, but they also get a sense of what's happening in the rest of the company. So, you know, they know when a new store is opening. They know that, you know, we're going to be opening a store in Japan. They know what's going on in audio. It just makes for a much more connected business. I think that I believe that the challenge becomes for a manager is that you have to be committed to get to know people. And you do have to know their names. It's so easy in a large company with the manufacturing in another building to walk around and not know anybody's names. And I think knowing everybody's names in the factories is a huge thing. It's not a small thing. And so I guess what I would say is some of the things that we do here as managers, it's not genius. It's simple human nature that people want people to know their name and they want to matter, right? They want to feel valued. All of us feel that way. So if you have everything in close proximity, it's much easier to do that.
You're listening to Shinola Vice President of Manufacturing, Jen Guarino. After this brief break, she talks about hiring and training a workforce.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
How involved are you with the actual hiring and, if we can touch it, firing of employees on the line of your artisans, as you put it?
So in terms of managing our workforce, there are always challenges. I really mentor and coach our direct supervisors to be able to do that themselves, but I'm often brought in challenging situations. I really strongly believe that sometimes having a candid conversation with someone that is maybe above your direct manager can help support and reinforce our expectations with people. And so I always make sure that when there's a challenge with someone that we have been honest, we've been candid, and we've given them the benefit of the doubt that once they hear this information, it's in their interest to improve.
Okay.
And if they haven't heard that, then that's not fair to them. Mm. So I get involved to make sure that they have heard it and they do understand the message and they do understand why we're having these conversations so that if it doesn't work out, it's really by their choice, not ours.
Sure. Where are you finding the employees? I mean, I imagine that, and you've suggested this, that is one of the big challenges when you're ramping up manufacturing of any kind. Where are they coming from?
So when we have open positions in our factories, there's several places we go. One, we go to, just like in anybody else does, you go to a employment agency, and they help us to find candidates. We also work with several workforce development agencies, social service agencies, that tap into certain communities. And what's wonderful about that is they can provide wraparound services. So for instance, if somebody needs support with transportation or with childcare or with clothing, some of these agencies are really supportive in getting people back into the workforce. So we work with several in that capacity. We also, now that we've been here for more than a couple years, we find a lot via referral. When we first started, nobody knew who we were. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a group of people that had happily been working here for a long period of time. But I'm happy to say that some of our best hires in the last year have come by referral, by our own employees going out and saying, hey, come work here. I like working here. And in some cases, it's even been family members.
Detroit itself is central to Shinola's branding. Is there an effort to hire locally as well as to produce locally?
We feel very committed to hiring locally. And one of the big things that we learned as we got to know our workforce here was that their opportunities to work in Detroit had shriveled to almost nothing, and most of them in their other manufacturing jobs had to commute outside of the city. So, you know, that's added time commitment, that's the cost of gas. If you're a single parent, it presents real challenges for childcare. So for us to be able to offer Detroit residents a local place to work is huge. So that's the first place we look, and we've been very successful at that.
When people are coming from other manufacturing industries, I mean, I'm guessing the automotive industry, mm-hmm. is that a big part of it? To what extent are there transferable skills that come from other sectors of manufacturing?
So when we first came to Detroit, our thought was manufacturing is in the DNA of the culture here, so we're going to be able to look to those people who lost their auto jobs and bring them into our factories. Well, it was a hard lesson. Some of those skills are transferable if they're very, let's just call it paint by numbers, right? So very, this piece goes A, B, C, D, and on the, down the line. Watches are much more that way. It's an assembly process. With leather, we learned the hard way that very few of those skills transferred. And the reason is this. In many of the auto factories, whether they're, you know, for the big three or just the supply chain, those people were not required or requested to think. It's all about just output. Do this and pass it. Do this and pass it. Well, we do ask our people to think. We do want their input. And so we need them to use discretion in deciding whether something should be passed down the line or not, or whether their own work meets an expectation or not. It is much more hands-on in terms of people managing their own quality. And there is a piece of what you do, at least in the leather factory, that you're in charge of. You're making decisions. And that was new. So we lost some people when we first hired. And the reason why we lost people was we realized that there was the reality of folks who hadn't done that before, and they weren't comfortable making their own decision. They weren't comfortable having to use their own discretion on making a decision on whether something should pass or not, or whether they could work with a piece of leather that has its own personality. So we changed our screening tactics. So we started screening for, all right, here's five pieces of leather. Here's the guidelines we go by. Which ones do you think pass? Okay? You'd be amazed at what percentage of people didn't feel comfortable doing that.
They just didn't want to make that decision in the first place.
Didn't want to make that decision. Didn't know how to make that decision. Hadn't been asked to make decisions in the past. So that was a big learning curve for us. Big, big learning curve. So once we sort of found those sorts of things and put together tests or interview questions that would lead us to find out if they had those skills, we became much more successful.
What are the skills that they have to learn once you've actually hired them? What kind of things do you have people doing with leather here?
Well, leather is an imperfect material. So a lot of what we have to teach is how to get to know leather. It behaves differently. It different types of leathers behave differently. So you might have one process that works perfectly for one type of leather, but you could do the same exact process with another piece of leather and it fails miserably. So there is a lot of training that goes into understanding this really unique material that we use. And that is not something you teach fast. That takes a lot of time handling and managing and cutting and splitting and painting and sewing to really get a sense of how leather behaves.
I would imagine that a certain amount of waste ends up going into the training process then. Is that something that you have to take into account when you think about working with your vendors and ordering supplies and such?
So when we first began, we knew that we would lose a lot of pieces, and we did. Now we have a good scrap rate. We manage it well. You can always improve it. But now we're at the point where we know what our standard should be, and so we hold our vendors accountable to, first off, delivering that standard to us to limit our waste, but then also to teach, you know, now new people how to minimize waste of something that is organic and ill-shaped, right? So it's not a square piece of material. Each side is a different shape. So you have to really, you're constantly problem solving in leather, constantly. It's very creative, actually. And I think that's why we see a high level of job satisfaction, because it is very creative. Every piece of leather is a new challenge.
You come with a manufacturing background. You come with a leather background. Have there been any things that really surprised you, any things that you had to learn in the process of scaling up the levels that you were working on?
Every day I learn something. I never stop learning in this business. Mostly because I have, you know, the fortune to be working in more than a few categories, ones that I haven't worked in before, but also because the industry is changing a lot. So technology, lean manufacturing, which has been around for a while, even it is sort of...
What does that mean?
Lean manufacturing is a philosophy of manufacturing that is the way to do it with the least waste, both in materials and steps and processes. And it streamlines. It's another way of saying streamline, right? Mm. So there's continuing studies on how manufacturing should evolve. For example, it's my belief that technology won't replace people, but people need to become friendly with technology. So on one hand, you should be able to sew something together without high-end technology, but it's that knowledge that helps you to run technology when it's introduced into the factory environment. So those two things go together. So I really believe that classic skills, when met with technology, is sort of the perfect sauce. But because technology is constantly changing, you're always learning what might be a new way to approach something.
Are there any particular technologies that have been introduced to the process while you've been here with Shinola?
There is technology that we are looking at right now that involves computers that will look at a side of leather and be able to recognize what you have marked as flawed and be able to nest patterns and cut around it with either lasers or knives. So that's a technology that's been in development for a while, but it's only now getting to the point where I think it's actually viable for manufacturing.
So it's like using machine vision to minimize waste, is that the idea?
That's right. So instead of, you know, an artisan standing in front of a hide and kind of visually looking and sort of punching out pieces, almost if you can envision a cookie cutter, this machine actually, you load in a pattern and it will nest to minimize waste of a side and work around any flaws that have been identified. We also have a technology that we use for stitching the perimeter of our strap that is a very unique technology, and it's programmable sewing. That's been around for a while, but what's unique about this is that the whole table turns so that the direction of the needle never changes. And why that's important is when you have something small like a strap, when you change the direction of a needle, it's really obvious. And on a small strap, it becomes like a billboard. So this machine gets around that. And that was developed in Italy. And so that technology would be an example of something that is, you know, fairly new.
You have a design background. Are you at all involved in the design process when a new product is being introduced into production?
We have a full leather design studio here, and they are a really, really competent team. So I am not involved in the creative direction of the designs or actually developing the design. Where I get involved, is when the designer's vision has been articulated through a prototype, and they say, yes, that's what we want, now let's go make it. I get involved, and our engineering team gets involved at that point, because now what we have to do is make sure that we can make it and make it in a way that is the best quality we can make it. And from a manufacturing standpoint, it makes sense. So we may go back to the designers and say, you know, I know you wanted the corner of the bag to do this, except that to do that is either going to make it a weak spot or it's going to be incredibly expensive to do that. So would you settle for this option? And so we'll go back with several options for consideration that we believe is an improvement. So in that respect, we're very involved with design, but it's at the point that their vision has been articulated in a way that we now have been asked to go make it work.
So is there a particular product that you could talk us through from when it first comes to you to when it shows up in stores for consumers?
A good example of our engagement with design would be our accordion crossbody, which we manufacture
here.
It's a bag. And it had very unique corners and pieces to it that were challenging because it is a bag where there's no opportunity to hide any messy parts. It's a very simple bag, and actually simple bags are harder to make because there is no place to hide any sort of, misstitch or so on and so forth.
Can you describe what it looks like to us?
The accordion crossbody is a crossbody bag that looks like layered envelopes, sort of. And all the edges are raw, and so they have to be painted. And there are corners that have to be hand-stitched. It's very labor-intensive. And the edges, because they're all exposed, have to be painted layer by layer by layer. So we had to go to design and say, okay, this is really labor-intensive, and because this is not a big bag, we can't go out and retail it for $1,000. We want it at a particular price point. So here's the option. So we came up with a different approach to the straps. We came up with a different approach to the edge painting. And that went through several iterations until now we have a bag that we're making money on. It's retailing. It's our number one selling bag in units. And we're doing it in a way that is now efficient. It works.
At what point does a price get attached to a product? Do the designers say, we want to charge X amount for it? Can you make that happen? Or do they come with a design and then you say, as it stands now, it's going to cost X. Should we get it to Y?
One of the biggest challenges of making the United States is hitting a marketable target retail that you feel good about, that there's a place for in the market, right? So design's challenge is to envision a product that's going to fill out part of their assortment within a price point that will make sense in the marketplace, so that when we land in a store, it's not like, what? How come that bag is that much when all these other bags are this much? So it's a real challenge. So what they'll do is they'll start with a target retail. And then we sort of assume some things about those products so that we can do sort of a flash costing so that we can see where we think it's going to cost. Now we're at the point where we have a product engineering team where they can say, you know what, we're not going to be able to hit that. That is not going to happen. And we're able to say that sooner so that we can say, all right, well, either A, we change the fundamental design and materials of this bag, or B, we're not doing it at all. So we're getting much, much better about design and engineering working together much earlier in the process so that we're working on things that, that really are viable for the market.
When you were first getting it ready for production, though, were there new skills that you had to teach to folks on the floor, that you had to work with them to develop new processes? Or?
So in the case of the crossbody, the challenges that presented were definitely challenges that artisans had not been exposed to before. So we had to work with our process engineers to demonstrate to them the approach that we would need to take for this bag. I would also say that the artisans themselves came to us and said, you know, this one thing is really, really hard to do. What if we did it this way? So the artisans were very involved in finding the best way to manufacture the bag. And one thing that's very important to note about our factory is, you know, we started making watch straps, and then we started making journal covers, and then we started to make handbags. We are continuing to increase the level of competency this factory has, because it is, you don't flip a switch and be and just suddenly enable a factory to make any kind of bag. So we carefully select bags that are pushing our limits so that we can continue to elevate what we can do, but are still within our limits so that we're delivering a product of high quality and at a cost that makes sense.
When a new product like that crossbody bag is introduced, does it mean that things have to be moved around in the factory space? Do you have to switch up elements of the larger workflow to introduce a new product into the process?
So when we have a new product, process engineering is key. So what we do first is we do several of the products just to understand the approach. Once we know that and we've done time studies to understand how much time all these presses are going to take, then you look at laying out the floor accordingly so that you don't either accidentally create a bottleneck that you didn't envision, or you have enough space because maybe you need more artisans for a particular process than for other products. So a layout is very, very much a part of that. Then you have to go back and revisit it after you've run it for a while. So after you've done it, you have to go back, talk to the artisans, and I would say 90% of the time there is something that you're going to tweak a little bit to make it better.
Is it important then for you to maintain those direct lines of communication with the people making the products to make sure that the process is flowing correctly, or is that mostly happen at other levels of the process?
I try to stay very connected to the process, mostly because I think it's important for the artisans to be heard. And because I've been here the longest, I like to make sure that this knowledge has been shared. So one of the things that we're really working on here is not to repeat lessons, but to make sure that they've been shared. So I would like to think that I've also learned a lesson. So when we are sitting in a meeting, that, you know, I'm able to contribute in an educated way rather than sitting in a meeting and not being able to contribute in any way. And I don't think you can do that if you're not on the floor a lot.
When you think forward toward scaling up production, as it sounds like you're constantly doing, when you introduce, you go from watch straps to journal covers to bags to whatever else is coming, is space ever an issue? Is that something that you have to be thinking about, how you're managing the actual amount of production floor, which I assume is limited in this building that we're in, which is an old school building, I guess?
We are now at the point of our factory maturity where we're running out of space. So, but it's good because it's forcing us to really look to lean principles, to take advantage of every single square foot we have and take a much closer look at workflow, to look at managing our material flow much closer to the manufacturing need. So it's forcing us to do what we need to be doing anyway, but the square footage demand is definitely becoming more and more challenging.
How do you confront that?
When we look at needing more space, we, you know, the first thing is, well, we need some more space. We need another floor. We need, and then we say, well, no, let's walk. So the first thing I always say, well, let's walk the floor together. And if you start walking the floor together, it's amazing how much square footage is available if you really start looking like
together
exactly.
More closely,
and you know, you can go vertical, you can reposition tables, you can reposition work centers. So whenever I hear that, that is always the first thing we do. Let's walk the floor. And walking the floor accomplishes a lot, and it forces you to look at everything a little bit differently. Again, it's another creative challenge.
You're listening to Jen Guarino. In a moment, she tells us how she became what she calls a factory nerd.
You're not a Detroit native. How long have you been living here now?
I moved to Detroit in June of 13, so it's almost been 4 years now.
What have you found Detroit? What's your experience of the city been?
Detroit has been the best surprise of my life. I came here with a certain image of what Detroit is or could be. It had its flaws in that, you know, I had heard some of the bad stories about Detroit. And
your image of the city had its flaws?
My image of the city was flawed.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's unusual for people that come to Detroit because, you know, the media has presented this image of Detroit that I think has a lot of flaws. And it's a city that has issues, no question, and they're real issues and they're deep issues, and the city's been through a lot. But I have been amazed at the people. I was not expecting to experience a culture that is down to earth, available, very straightforward. What you see is what you get. Somehow I was expecting it to be a really tough city. And I find it to be a very hospitable city. And I did not expect that. So Detroit for me has been just sort of one surprise after the next. And I find it to be a very collaborative city. And I also see it to be sort of a can-do city. I think there's a certain element of, why not? Let's just try it, mm-hmm. You know? And so I enjoy that part of the city.
One thing we do know about Detroit, and this shapes those images, flawed or otherwise, that I think many of us, including me, especially me, who aren't from here, have, is that it is a very poor city. I think per capita, it may be the poorest major metropolitan area in the United States. Are you ever conscious of, or do you ever find yourself thinking about what it means to be involved intimately in the production of a luxury good or luxury goods in a city with such high poverty rates?
There have been critics about, whether making a high-end product in Detroit is counter to the needs of Detroit. Well, I just simply vehemently disagree with that. Mm. If that was the case, then we shouldn't be making high-end cars here. It's a job creator, you know, and it's real. And so I don't have an issue with that. I have just absolutely zero issue with that. Mm-hmm. So now if we weren't using Detroiters to build this company, okay, then maybe there might be a basis for that. But I just simply just do not agree with that. There is a market for this product. So if there's a market for the product, why not make it in Detroit? Because it's economically challenged? Well, that makes no sense. It just simply does not make any sense. But there are challenges with Detroit that are frustrating and are tough to get your mind around. The poverty rate, the education system is really, really, really challenged at best. So there are things that, as a Detroit resident now, that I involve myself with outside of Shinola on a daily basis, because I think to live in Detroit and not be involved in the community and involved in what's needed is not very responsible.
You do spend a lot of time, it seems like, thinking about leather.
Yeah.
Maybe even visiting tanneries. Are you a leather nerd? Are there things about leather that you really appreciate or enjoy?
You know, I think when I moved to Detroit, I would qualify as a leather geek for sure. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that my I think my geekness, shall we say, has now expanded into manufacturing in general. I mean, I love going to factories now. I'm a total factory geek.
Like other people's factories as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love going to other people's factories. I love it. There are so many cool things to see in factories. The way things get made is just fascinating to me. So I think what started as being a leather geek has now, I think I'm just a factory geek now.
When you visit another company's factory, what are you looking for? What are you looking at?
Oh, I'm looking for equipment that does things that I didn't know existed. I'm looking for a process that I never understood before. I'm looking for things that, wow, now there's a unique way to do that. I'll bet we could try that for this, you know? So I just love looking at factories. I absolutely love it. I'll take an invite to go visit a factory any day.
Are there any factories that you recommend people tour? Any that have been pretty cool?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you one that I saw a couple years ago, and it still sticks in my mind because it's so interesting. There is a company in L.A. that actually assembles zippers. So it puts the teeth on long tape. So they've got these huge reels that feed tape and these machines that rivet all the teeth on. It looks like something out of Willy Wonka. Really.
Sounds riveting.
It is riveting. So that one that sticks in my mind. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think manufacturing is fascinating. And by the way, I think that when you get children exposed to that in a way that's exciting, they're so curious. They're fascinated by it. So I think we would do a great service to our society to get kids involved in visiting factories at a very, very young age.
What is your favorite part of this whole process that you're involved with?
My favorite part is at the beginning of the day, it wasn't there, and at the end of the day, it is. And that actually somebody wants to pay to own it. I think that's a really, really satisfying, cool thing. And so to take something that in today's world, so much is two-dimensional. You know, we're looking at screens, it's digital. But when you see flat elements or a bunch of different components come together in a three-dimensional way that works, and it didn't exist at the beginning of the day, and at the end of the day, it now does, I just find that fascinating.
You talked about introducing new machines, new technology into the production process. But a lot of what Shinola sells is by design, by aesthetic, and otherwise, harkens back to older analog technologies. You have turntables, you have watches with mechanical movements, you have really sturdy leather goods, bicycles. Do you find it helpful ever to look back to old factory production styles, the kinds of conditions that would have been employed to construct these things 50 or 60 or 100 or more years ago?
I think when we're approaching the development of a new product category, I think we have a huge amount of respect for the history of the way something used to be made. And typically that plays out in a way we bring in partners that have an industry knowledge that is both contemporary but also historical. So we don't try to do these things by ourselves. We never have. We always go and look for someone that's been doing it and has known how to do it. So in the case of Sky Jaeger, our head of development for our bicycles, is an amazing designer and engineer. And her approach is very classic, but yet very in tune with current technology. And I think in one way to look at it is if you're in art school, before you might try something abstract or maybe something very high tech, you're taught how to sketch. Mm-hmm. You're taught three-dimensional drawing, right? You start with the basics. And I think when we're looking at our, if you want to call them analog products, I think we start there first. And then we go from there. And we don't shy away from digital or technology, but we start at the simplicity of design first.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us and share your work with us today.
Thanks for having us.
It was our pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. If you're looking for something else to listen to, we want to recommend that you check out Lexicon Valley, a podcast about language, from pet peeves, syntax and etymology, to neurolinguistics and the death of languages. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about Working itself. Our email address is working@slate.com. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Kapper.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise, and with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.